Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome, everyone. This is Jessica Zhu. I am Assistant Professor of Religion at University of Southern California at Dornsife and the New Books Network host in Buddhist Studies. Today, we are very lucky to have Professor Qin Geng from National Taiwan University to talk with us about his new book, Toward a New Image of Paramatta, Yogacara and Tathagatagarbha Buddhism Revisited. This is published by Bloomsbury Series, Studies in World Philosophies in 2023. So welcome, Qin. Thank you so much for devoting this monograph to such an important yet very understudied philosopher in world philosophy, Paramatta. It's certainly one of the most difficult books for me to read, so I cannot imagine how much work and care you put into researching and writing this important monograph. While I'm not sure I can fully follow the complex logic and arguments in your chapters, but I do find your book raises many far-reaching questions that I feel many more aspiring philosophers and scholars of Buddhist philosophy should follow up. Thanks to your book, for example, I realized that I never read any of Paramatta's translations in detail, even though I claim I do Yogacara, Vinyabdhimatra. But after reading your book, I realized that I cannot continue dodge this issue by claiming that I only do modern Yogacara, thus only focus on Xuanzang and Kuiji. But, you know, to fill up this big hole in my own knowledge, I have started reading Paramatta's Shi Da Cheng Lun, Mahasangha, Mahayana Sangraha with my friends on a weekly basis. I hope the listeners will find similar inspirations in this interview to start their own investigation of this fascinating philosopher and this complex and still evolving philosophical tradition of Yogacara and Vinyabdhimatra. And I certainly hope more listeners will pick up this important book and start reading it. Also, to share a bit of my own reading experience, even if you are like me, who often felt totally lost, unable to follow the logic or the technical aspect of things, you can still get a sense of the big picture. The book has touched upon so many unanswered questions, fascinating philosophical paradoxes, and forgotten episodes in history, so that it compels others to come and study more and join the conversation.
Okay, thank you, Jessica, for your wonderful introduction, for your invitation and for the wonderful introduction and kind words. It's my great honor and pleasure to discuss my book with you. I cannot agree more with you that Paramatta is a fascinating figure who remains understudied, and am hoping that my book will be able to draw more interest in him. I was happy to know that you started reading Paramatta's Shi Da Cheng Lun, and I'm hoping that my book will be of some use for your purpose. I should mention at the beginning that given the time constraints, I have to skip a lot of details. The audience should feel free to contact me for any further questions.
Thank you, Qin. I'll make sure I put your contact in our New Books Network blog post.
Yes, please do.
Yeah, so Qin, normally I'd start interview with the traditional New Books Network question on your own intellectual journey, your biography, what led you to work on Paramatta, and so on and so forth. But today, because Parramatta is such an understudied figure. So to better orient our listeners, could you please first explain to us very briefly who was Parramatta? What did he do? And what was China like during Parramatta's time? And why it is so important for us to know about his works and his philosophy? And what are the main difficulties or obstacles in studying him?
Yeah, sure. Let me begin with some brief information about Parramatta. Parramatta originated from Western India and was invited to Southern China to translate Buddhist texts. When he arrived in Nanjing at the age of 48 in 546, however, the Liang dynasty was already in a political turmoil, which interrupted his translation work. At one point, he planned to quit and left China, but he changed his mind due to the invitation by a local official in Guangzhou and stayed there until his death in 569. It was in his last career when he met excellent Chinese disciples and translated his most important works, including Vasubandhu's Abhidhamma Kosha Bhashya, Abhidhammo Chisalun, Vasubandhu's 20 verses, Da Sheng Gui Shi Lun, etc. The most important work among his translation is Se Da Sheng Lun, or simply Se Lun, namely Parmartha's translation of Asanga's Mahayana Sangraha, together with Vasubandhu's commentary. In addition to his translation of the Abhidhamma and Yogacara texts, Parmartha is also regarded by later Chinese Buddhist texts, Buddhist tradition, as the translator of the Awakening of Faith, Da Sheng Qi Xing Lun, a seminal Tathagatagarbha text that has been extremely influential in East Asian Buddhist traditions. Beginning from the 20th century, as some of you may know, serious doubts have been cast on the traditional attribution of the Awakening of Faith to Parramatta. And this attribution is an essential part of what I call the traditional image of Parramatta, which I shall challenge in this book. So why then is it important to study Parramatta? First, Parramatta is a key figure in understanding the issue of the sinicization of Buddhism, namely how Indian Buddhism became Chinese Buddhism. That is to say, if we read Tamakirti, roughly 7th century, in parallel with Fazang, also roughly 7th century, then would have a feeling that they were dealing with very different issues in quite different manners. And this feeling would become even stronger if we compare the works of Tsongkhapa, for example, with the Changgong'ans. Along the same line, one of the hottest debates in Chinese Buddhism is the criticism of Parramatta from Xuanzang's disciples. This is the dispute between the so-called new translation, Xing Yi, by Xuanzang, versus the old translation, Jiu Yi, by Parramatta. But we may wonder, both Xuanzang and Parramatta translated Yogacara works, so why did they disagree with each other? A still popular assumption here is that Parramatta was influenced by Tathagatagarbha, namely by the Awakening of Faith, and hence deviated from the orthodox Indian Yogacara transmitted by Xuanzang. Later on, Parramatta and the Awakening of Faith became the mainstream of Chinese Buddhism, and this marks the beginning of the sinicization of Buddhism. I should also mention that the sinicization of Buddhism is still relevant even in Buddhism in the 20th century, as reflected in the debates between Lü Chen, a focus of your study, Jessica, and Xiong Shi Li. Another important aspect of the study of Parramatta is that he provides invaluable information about the transition of Indian Buddhism between Vasubandhu and Dignaga on the one side, and the Dhammapala and Pavivega on the other. For example, in chapter 6 of this book, I propose that the approximate to the notion of 解性, the focal point of this whole book, is not to be found in the awakening of faith, but rather is in the translations of Xuanzang. In other words, in Paramartha's work, we find a primitive form of a notion whose more developed form is found in Xuanzang. So Paramartha can serve as a missing piece between Vasubandhu and Dhammapada. But as shown in this book, Paramartha has been distorted by the later Chinese reinterpretations, mainly through the lens of the awakening of faith. To find out any correct information about Indian Buddhism from Paramartha's work, the first step would be to recover the real Paramartha, and this is the mission of my book.
Thank you, Qing, for such a introduction of this fascinating figure. And I think the most important aspect for the listeners is that instead of putting Paramartha and Xuanzang on opposite ends of things, actually, your book is trying to put them in a continually evolving line of how Yogacara evolved from India. Yeah. Yes. I just want to prime our listeners that we've been talking about Sheda Chenglun or Mahayana Sangraha. Its English translation is a summary of the Great Vehicle, and both Xuanzang and Paramartha translated this text by Asanga. Yes. So now, Qing, I'd like to follow up with the traditional New Books Network. Could you please tell our listeners a bit more about yourself and how you came to research on Paramartha?
Mm-hmm. Sure. I grew up and did my basic academic training in Taiwan until I went to pursue my PhD at Harvard University in 2001. And this book is a revision of my doctoral dissertation submitted in 2009. And it took me a long time to revise this book and finally publish it. So I decided to work on Paramartha for two reasons. First, I was very much intrigued by the issue of the sinicization of Buddhism, as reflected in the debates between Paramartha and Xuanzang. This interest was inspired mainly by my advisor, Professor Robert Gemello, one of the most knowledgeable scholars of Chinese Buddhism, and also a very pious practicing Catholic. Second, through Professor Gemello and my classmate, Michael Radich, currently professor of Buddhist study at the University of Heidelberg, I learned that Professor Tolu Funayama at Kyoto University was about at that time to conduct a 5-year research seminar on Paramartha. I then decided to work on Paramartha because I was hoping to take advantage of Professor Funayama's seminar and learn from his from him and from his colleagues. I'm most grateful to these three people for leading me into this journey of discovery.
Thank you, Qing. I hope your journey will inspire many more scholars to undertake such sophisticated studies that combine philology, philosophy, and sinology. So your book has 7 chapters with the introduction and the conclusion. I want to start with the introduction. So in the introduction, you outline for us what is the traditional image of Paramartha and what are the known problems with this traditional image and what are the status of the current scholarship in both Japanese and English mainly on this topic and how your book pushes the field forward. We will reveal your book chapter by chapter, but for now, could you please just briefly explain to us the key problems you want to solve in this book and how you plan to do it?
Yes. The main thesis of this book is that the traditional image of Paramartha is a distorted one. It represents a reinterpretation of Paramartha, mainly through the lens of the awakening of faith. And what I mean by the traditional image of Paramartha consists of two parts. First, Paramartha synthesizes Yogacara and Tathagatagarbha traditions by introducing Tathagatagarbha notions into his translation of Yogacara texts. Second, it was Paramartha who translated the awakening of faith. This again proves that Paramartha endorses Tathagatagarbha thought. In the introduction, I identified 3 presuppositions underlying the traditional image of Paramartha. A, Paramartha was the translator of the original faith. B, Paramartha stood against the Xuanzang because the latter transmitted the kind of Yogacara that was not blended with Tathagatagarbha. C, Yogacara and Tathagatagarbha were two opposing and incompatible traditions in Indian Buddhism. In this book, I shall suggest that none of the three presuppositions are true. Concerning the current state of the field, there is actually very little study about Paramartha in English. Diana Paul's book from 1984 entitled Philosophy of Mind in 6th Century China, Paramartha's Evolution of Consciousness, provides studies of a work entitled Zhuan Shi Lun that is traditionally attributed to Paramartha, which scholars mostly agree that it was a kind of variant translation of the Trimshika. And in addition, Sally King's 1991 book entitled Buddha Nature is a study of Paramartha's Foxing Lun, or in English, a treatise on Buddha Gotra. However, neither of these two books challenges the traditional image of Paramartha. Now, concerning scholarship on Paramartha in East Asia, the majority among Buddhologists in East Asia still hold the view that the awakening of faith is closely related to Paramartha, even if it was not directly translated by him. Recently, however, a scholar called named O Take Susumu's book, published in 2017, convincingly shows that the awakening of faith cannot have been translated by Paramartha, because it is a patchwork of words or phrases from Chinese Buddhist texts circulated in 6th century northern China. This book joins Odake by suggesting that the key notion of Paramarthas have been misinterpreted due to the association of the awakening of faith with Paramartha. So again, this book aims at deconstructing the traditional image of Paramartha. My main thesis is that the traditional image was mainly the result of interpreting Paramartha through the lens of the awakening of faith.
Thank you, Qing, for orienting the readers and listeners about the state of the field and your own main thesis. So chapter one zooms into a key term that is central to an accurate understanding of Paramartha's philosophy, which you already primed us in the introduction, Jixing. Could you please tell us what are the two competing readings of Jixing, as you call them, the permanence reading and impermanence reading, and what are some of the evidences, pieces of evidence that you think could help us disentangle or possibly disentangle Paramartha's own use of this term, and what you call the later reinterpretation of Paramartha through the lens of awakening phase. Maybe also, for example, its complicated relations or intertextualities with Da Cheng Qi Xin Lun, Awakening Phase through Fa Zhang's Huayan tradition. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Jixing is the focal point of this whole book, as mentioned before. It is a notion that appears only two times in Paramartha's Shi Lun. The first time simply says that Jixing is something innate to the storehouse consciousness, Ali Yeshi. The second occurrence states that when one starts to tread on the Buddhist path, the innate Jixing becomes mixed with the permeation or perfumation of hearing, Wen Xunxi, from outside. And this mixture then serves as the basis for a noble person, the Aryas. From Paramartha's two passages, however, it is hard to tell exactly what Jixing meant for him. In chapter 1, I trace all the occurrences of this notion Jixing in the Chinese Buddhist canon and conclude that almost all authors identify Jixing with the ocean of with the notion of original awakening, Benjue, in the awakening of faith. At first look, This seems to support the traditional image of Paramattha. Namely, he introduces Tathagatagarbha notion, such as jiexing, into his translation of Yogacara texts, and hence make a synthesis between Yogacara and Tathagatagarbha. However, with the help of C-beta, namely searchable digital Chinese Buddhist canon, I found a different interpretation of jiexing, preserved in a long-lost fragment that was found in Dunhuang in the early 20th century, namely Dunhuang manuscript in the Oriel Stein collection, number 2747, which is also included in the Taisho canon as Taisho number 2805. The difference between the two interpretations is pretty straightforward. According to the interpretation that identifies jiexing with original awakening, jiexing is unconditioned because original awakening is unconditioned. In the awakening of faith, original awakening is unconditioned because it is identified with the Dhamma body, Dhammakaya or Fasen of the Buddha, which is unanimously agreed to be unconditioned. In contrast, the interpretation in Taisho 2805 rejects outright the identification of jiexing with Dhamma body and insists that jiexing is conditioned, wuchang or anidya in Sanskrit. For those who are not familiar with these notions of unconditioned and conditioned, this is a basic distinction among dharmas originating from the Abhidharma tradition. Condition means causally conditioned. Whatever that has a cause is conditioned. Conversely, unconditioned refers to that which has no cause and hence remains the same permanently. So now the crucial difference is, if jiexing is unconditioned, meaning that it lies outside of any causal chains, and hence jiexing will be permanent and never changes. Conversely, if jiexing is conditioned, then it belongs to a causal chain and must be impermanent. So now we have two interpretations of jiexing, what I call permanence reading, that is associated with the awakening of faith, versus the impermanence reading, that is preserved in Taisho 2805. So the next issue would be to determine which of the two interpretations better represents Paramattha's original thought.
Thank you, Qing, for laying out these main threads in your coming arguments. So permanence reading against impermanence reading, which one is more closer to Paramattha's thinking? So now in chapter 2, you lead readers deeper into the history and reception of Paramattha and cast doubt on the attribution of awakening faith to him. Could you please reiterate for the listeners who have yet to read your book, what are the main philosophical evidence that allow you to clarify Paramattha's relationship with this awakening phase that's so influential in all of East Asian Buddhism? And I'm thinking about the key doctrinal differences between what you just mentioned, the conditioned and unconditioned dharmas.
Yes. In chapter 2, the main goal is to ask the readers to pause and to reflect upon possible weakness of the traditional image of Paramattha. The traditional image is founded on the attribution of the awakening phase to Paramattha. Namely, the traditional image tells us that Paramattha introduces Tathagatagarbha notions such as jiexing into his Se Lun. Under this account, jiexing is interpreted to mean the same thing as original awakening in the awakening phase. But the problem is, as is well known, that since early 20th century, the attribution of the awakening phase to Paramattha has been called into serious doubt. Now imagine if the awakening phase has been proved to be unconnected with Paramattha, what would happen to the traditional image? To cast doubt on the attribution, I first review the debates about the origin of the awakening phase and conclude that all the pieces of evidence for its Indian origin are not persuasive. but with only one exception, namely the only strong evidence for the association of the awakening of faith with Paramartha is that the earliest teachers of the awakening of faith were at the same time the earliest teachers of Paramartha's servant. This is a historical fact that endorses the close connections between awakening of faith and Paramartha. And I shall refute this piece of evidence in chapter 5. Second, I point out in chapter 2 the philosophical or doctrinal difference between the awakening of faith and Paramartha. In the works of Paramartha, it is explicitly claimed that unconditioned dharma cannot function because it lies outside of any causal chains. For the same reason, unconditioned dharma cannot be acted upon or permeated. But the awakening of faith unequivocally claims that thusness, being unconditioned, can permeate ignorance from within and can also be permeated by ignorance. This distinction between the awakening of faith and Paramartha cannot be overemphasized and will be a recurring theme throughout this book. Finally, suppose I can show that Taisho 2805, which preserves the impermanence reading of Jieshing, is closely connected with Paramartha. Then this would serve as an indirect, albeit quite strong, in my opinion, evidence against the attribution of the awakening of faith to Paramartha. Bear in mind that the awakening of faith supports the permanence reading of Jieshing. And this text is what I shall do in chapter 3 and chapter 4.
Great. Now let's segue into chapter 3. And chapter 3, to be honest, is the most difficult chapter for me. It's very philological. I have to go back and forth between the charts in your book and your main text, and then back to your main text, and then sometimes go back to the text, Taishu 2805, just to get a sense of the impressive amount of evidence you laid out for the readers, because, you know, it references to, you know, different terms in different texts, and compare that with Paramartha's kind of confirmed translations, and then T2805. So, but without these visual aids, right, it's quite difficult to explain here in this podcast to the listeners what's going on. So maybe you could give us one or two examples of your philological evidence, like the idiosyncratic terms that Paramartha used that also appeared in the Dunhuang manuscript, Stein Collection 2747, also called now Taishu 2805, and why these philological details are important for your argument.
Sure. And I think you are quite right that Chapter 3 is a philological study of Taisho 2805. And when I tried to identify the possible author of Taisho 2805, I came across difficulties that seem unresolvable. Almost no study was ever done about this fragment. We don't know anything about its date nor about its author. One of my teachers once suggested to me to try using carbon 14 dating, but I think that would not work. First of all, the British Library, which houses the original fragment, may not allow me to do the test. Second, by the dating, we know at best the rough dates of the paper and the ink, but we still have no idea about the date of the content. So at that time, I thought I was moving toward a dead end. With the help of C beta, a breakthrough came when I realized that Paramartha and his translation team used some idiosyncratic terminology, which almost no other translators shared. Here, I just give our audience just one most distinct example. All translators of Chinese Buddhist texts, including Kumara Jiva, Xuanzang, etc., use the term wu lou, meaning no leaking, for the Sanskrit term anasrava. But Paramartha used the wu liu, no outflow. And to my surprise, Taisho 2805 consistently follows this idiosyncratic terminology of Paramartha. And what is even more striking is a colloquial phrase in Chinese, ji wu fu, meaning something like now it is no more the case that, etc., blah, 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 appears only 9 times throughout the whole Chinese Buddhist canon. Among these 9 occurrences, a text by Paramartha entitled Sui Xiang Lun used this phrase Ji Wu Fu 3 times, and the fragment Taisho 2805 uses it twice. Based on this, I think it is very likely that the author of Taisho 2805 was the scribe when Paramartha translated the Sui Xiang Lun. Further, I also suggest that the author of Taisho 2005 originated from southern China, because this fragment uses several terms that were never used in northern China. Finally, a few anonymous examples suggest that Taisho 2805 was composed after its author had some contact with Buddhism in northern China around 590. Especially with Hui Yuan of the Jingyin Temple, usually called Jingyin Si Hui Yuan, who was a famous scholar monk of the Dilun tradition during early Sui Dynasty. The philological evidence provided is quite strong for proving that Taisho 2805 was very close to Paramartha's translation team, and hence should have preserved Paramartha's authentic teaching about Jiexing. However, I think this is not enough, because it is still possible, although unlikely, that counter evidence exists in the text that were lost. Hence, I think the philological evidence is not conclusive. I need to find more evidence to prove the close connection between Taisho 2805 and Paramartha, and I do this in the following chapter 4 and chapter 5.
Awesome. So let's segue into chapter 4. So in this chapter, you switch back to the philosophical and doctrinal modes of analysis. So you argue that there is remarkable doctrinal consistency between Taisho 2805 of Stein 2747 and some of the known Paramartha's works. Some of the central concepts that you analyze for the readers here is, for example, like Xin Yi Shi, mind, mentation, and consciousness, Liao Yin, the disclosing cause. At which stage of the Bodhisattva path is the Dharma body attained? Those are the kind of 3 main themes I picked up. So for the benefits of the listeners, could you please maybe pick 1 or 2 main lines of argument in this chapter and explain to us what are some of the doctrinal consistencies that you see in addition to the philological kind of consistency?
Sure. So in chapter 4, I show that Taisho 2805 shares with other works of Paramartha several doctrinal positions that were uncommon around the late 6th to early 7th century. It is particularly striking that even when Paramartha's Selun deviates and differs from the original text of Sangha or Vasubandhu, Taisho 2805 consistently agrees with Paramartha. And Taisho 2805 also provides some insight into the obscure passages in the Selun about the connection between the storehouse consciousness and the enjoyment body, Sambhoga Kaya, or Shou Yong Shen in Chinese. Based on this point of agreement between Taisho 2805 and Paramartha, I conclude that Taisho 2805 must have preserved the authentic teaching of Paramartha, a conclusion that corroborates my observations in chapter 3. In particular here, I want to draw the audience's attention to the idea present both in Paramartha's work and in Taisho 2805, namely the idea that Dharma body is unconditioned and the enjoyment body is conditioned. Paramartha's work and Taisho 2805 also share the idea that after one becomes a Buddha, namely after the so-called transformation of the basis, in Sanskrit, Ashraya Paravarti or Ashraya Parivarti, the storehouse consciousness becomes the enjoyment body. Note here that in the storehouse consciousness, there was jiexing together with the defiled karmic seeds from previous lives. And after one hears the Buddhist teachings, jiexing becomes mixed with the permeation of hearing from outside. And the whole Buddhist path eventually eliminates all the defiled seeds. So when all the defiled seeds have been eliminated, what remains in the storehouse consciousness is the mixture between jiexing and the permeation of hearing. So the idea that the storehouse consciousness become the enjoyment body, which is conditioned, also confirms the idea that jiexing is conditioned, which supports the impermanence reading in Taisho 2805. And this agreement between Taisho 2805 and Paramartha's work, together with the philological evidence from Chapter 3, confirms that Taisho 2805 was closely connected with Paramartha's translation team. And in the following Chapter 5, I shall move on to give an answer about who the possible author of Taisho 2805 was.
Thank you, Qing. So Chapter 5 is a historical argument. It's built upon the philological and philosophical arguments in the previous two chapters, but expands them. So could you explain to our listeners how historically the traditional image of Paramartha arose and who were the main advocates for such a portrayal of Paramartha? And why did they link him with awakening of faith? And then in addition, who were the true authors, possible authors of Taisho 2805?
Yes. So in Chapter 5, I mainly collect the historical clues behind the disagreement between the permanence reading associated with the awakening of faith versus the impermanence reading associated with Taisho 2805. I begin with reviewing the reports around 600 in capital Chang'an from the Sanlun master Ji Zhang and his colleague Hui Jin about the two different views held by Paramartha's disciples, namely the so-called Selun masters, Selun Shi. Between these two views, I show that one agrees with the permanence reading and the other agrees with the impermanence reading. This indicates that around the year 590 to 600 in Chang'an, there were two groups of Selun masters. I name them Selun-Awakening of Faith lineage and Selun-Taisho 2805 lineage, respectively. I then pinpoint a monk named Tan Qian as the leader of the Selun-Awakening of Faith lineage. Tan Qian was a monk from northern China and fled to the south during the persecution of Buddhism by Emperor Wu of the northern Zhou dynasty. He came across Paramartha's work in Nanjing and then taught them when he got back to Chang'an in 587. Two things were crucial about Tan Qian. First, he was regarded as the earliest promoter of Paramartha's teaching in northern China, but he never studied with Paramartha nor with any of his disciples. Second, Tan Qian was closely connected with the awakening of faith because he taught Paramartha's Selun together with the awakening of faith. So for these two reasons, I identify Tan Qian as the leader of the Selun-Awakening of Faith lineage. Concerning the possible author of Taisho 2805, let's review again the clues I gathered from Chapter 3. The author of Taisho 2805 should have been a disciple of Paramartha, most likely the scribe when Paramartha translated the Shuixianglun. And this author originated from southern China, because he used the terminology that was never used in northern China. But somehow, this author also knew the key notions of Hui Yuan of the Jingying Temple in Chang'an. Now, if we look in the Xu Gaosheng Zhuan, or the continued biography of eminent monks, for possible candidates of the author of Taisho 2805, then bingo! There's indeed a monk named Dao Ni who matches all the clues. Dao Ni was a disciple of Paramahansa, originating from southern China, but was summoned by the emperor to Chang'an in 590. I hence suggest that Dao Ni was the most likely author of Taisho 2805 and the head of the Shelun-Taisho 2805 lineage. We know, however, almost nothing about Dao Ni's career in Chang'an, but the little information suggests that he died just a few years after he arrived. This explains why the Shelun-Taisho 2805 lineage soon disappeared from history. In contrast, Tan Qian's lineage flourished to the extent that it was regarded as the only heir of Paramahansa. And Tan Qian's close connection with the Awakening Phase explains why the Awakening Phase was later regarded as Paramahansa's work. So far, I've shown that there are two interpretations of Jiexin, the permanence reading associated with the Awakening Phase versus the impermanence reading preserved in Taisho 2805. And in chapters 3 to 5, I show how Taisho 2805 is close to Paramahansa's translation team in terms of terminology, doctrines, and historical evidence. And hence, it is the impermanence reading that should be considered have preserved the authentic teaching of Paramahansa about Jiexin. So then the next question is, what exactly is Jiexin?
Thank you, Qing. Just for the benefit of listeners, I just want to summarize the key argument in this long explanation. It's like there are two groups. One is led by the Shelun Awakening Phase group, and then the main promoter is Tan Qian, and the other is the Shelun and Taisho 2805 lineage. That's main figure is Dao Ni, who unfortunately died soon after he arrived in Chang'an. I also want to mention this for the benefits of our listeners that Sui Xianglun treatise on the second remark is a relatively uncontroversial work with regard to its provenance. It's just like everybody kind of agrees Paramahansa's work. And then it's Taisho 1641. I don't think I've mentioned this detail in our previous conversation. Okay, so enough to about the details. So now moving on to chapter 6. So in chapter 6, Qing, you switch back to the philosophical and doctrinal modes of analysis. You finally give us your own analysis of Jiexin, both as how Paramahansa used it and how later traditions interpreted it. So could you please, for the benefits of listeners, explain what is actually Jiexin according to Paramahansa and why it is important for us to know this?
Yeah. So from what we gathered from Paramahansa's Shelun and Taisho 2805, we know that Jiexin is something innate to the storehouse consciousness. And it begins to become mixed with the permeation of hearing Wen Xunxi from outside after one hears the Buddhist teachings. It is something impermanent. But this is pretty much all. So here I came across another difficulties, namely, it is still hard to know what exactly Jiexin is, even if we combine all the clues in Shelun and in Taisho 2805. So again, this seems to be another dead end that I ran into. And here I made a reflection. The traditional image of Paramahansa has been distorted by his association with the Awakening Phase, And for this reason, Paramartha was criticized by Xuanzang's disciples. But now, if I have proved that the original face was not connected with Paramartha, then the disagreement between Paramartha and Xuanzang might not be that wide as it was usually assumed. So I was wondering, can I possibly try to find clues about Jiexing in the works of Xuanzang? After I made this move, I realized that strikingly similar ideas could indeed be found in the translations of Yogacara works by Xuanzang, notably in the Cheng Wei Shi Lun, or the establishment of the theory of consciousness only, and the Fo Di Jing Lun, or in English, Treatise on the Buddha Bumi Sutra. Therefore, it is both legitimate and fruitful to examine what is said about Jiexing in later Chinese works by Xuanzang. Here, I have to skip a lot of details. So basically, the characterizations of Jiexing in Paramartha's work and Taisho 2805 is very close to the idea of originally existent uncontaminated seeds in Chinese, 本有无漏种子, in the Cheng Wei Shi Lun, or originally existent uncontaminated Buddha Gotra, 本有无漏种性, in the Fo Di Jing Lun. The ideas of seeds and Buddha Gotra also suggest that Jiexing is conditioned. According to both Paramartha and Xuanzang, Jiexing, or the originally existent uncontaminated seeds or Buddha Gotra, exists from beginning this time in the storehouse consciousness. It becomes mixed with the permeation of hearing from outside and continues to the end of the Buddhist path. After the transformation of the basis, Jiexing becomes the enjoyment body of the Buddha. The development of Jiexing to the enjoyment body is a causal process, with both Jiexing and enjoyment body being conditioned. So to conclude chapter 6, Jiexing refers to a primitive form of the idea of uncontaminated seeds or Buddha Gotra that were further developed in the works of Xuanzang. We failed to see this because we were too much biased or misled by the traditional image of Paramartha, and hence by mistake thought Paramartha and Xuanzang held diametrically different views.
Well, this is a very surprising finding. So Paramartha's Jiexing is really a crucial link in understanding the development of the idea, the Yogacara idea of uncontaminated seeds.
Mm-hmm. But to be honest, when I started this journey, I never expected this.
This is very, very surprising. So, I just like put a plug for the future scholars. There are probably many more other similar links that are yet to be discovered.
Sure.
Yes. So in chapter 7, Qing, you made a historical argument by demonstrating that the continuity between Paramartha's Yogacara and later Xuanzang's Yogacara. So the title of this chapter is your argument. Basically, you said this is titled Paramartha as a Successor to Vasubandhu. Could you please tell us more? What are the continuities and differences between the three, among the three philosophers, Vasubandhu, Paramartha, and Xuanzang?
Mm-hmm. Sure. The question I aim to answer in chapter 7 is, if Paramartha is proved not to be the translator of the awakening of faith, then to what extent, if any, does Paramartha still subscribe to Dhatagaragarbha thought? And to answer this question, I first draw attention to Vasubandhu, who already incorporates the notion of Dhatagaragarbha in his Mahayana Sangraha Bhashya. According to Vasubandhu, to the extent that every sentient being shares thusness, Dhatata, Zhenru, every sentient being is a Dhatagaragarbha, namely contains a Dhatagata. In fact, the Ratnagotra Vibhaga, which is often regarded as the most important Tathagatagarbha treatise, expresses the same idea, that to the extent that every sentient being shares thusness, every sentient being hence is a Tathagatagarbha. When thusness is entangled with defilements, it is named Tathagatagarbha. But when defilements are all eliminated, thusness is disclosed to be the Dhamma body of the Buddhas. To the extent that Dhamma body is identified with thusness, and hence is unconditioned, I think Paramartha agrees with Vasubandhu and Ratnagotra Vibhaga. So my main point is this. If Paramartha is criticized for incorporating the notion of Tathagatagarbha and somehow distorts Yogacara, then Vasubandhu should be the one who is to be blamed. Further, I explore Paramartha's work, notably his Foxing Lun, treatise on the Buddha Gotra, to point out that for Paramartha, Dharma body consists of both thusness and the jnana, namely knowledge or insight about thusness. This, I think, is a further development beyond Vasubandhu. In other words, every sentient being is originally endowed with Dhamma body, which consists in both thusness and the jnana about thusness. The latter means that every sentient being possesses innate knowledge, such as everything is empty. Despite this, one still needs a causal process of learning from a teacher to become aware of that innate knowledge. And jiexing is what makes this causal process possible. But to answer your final question, namely the difference between Paramartha and Xuanzang, I'm still trying to work this out. So I hope I can reserve that for a future article.
Awesome. Thank you, Qing. So finally, we've reached the conclusion part of your monograph, where you outline for us the implications and future research directions. So could you please highlight for our listeners some of the main points here, especially regarding the methodological issues in working with Chinese Buddhist texts?
Good. And to summarize the whole book, there are two interpretations of jiexing, the permanence reading versus the impermanence reading. The former is connected with the awakening phase, whereas the latter with Taisho 2805. I show that Taisho 2805 is similar to Paramartha's work, both in terms of terminology and doctrines. And hence, it is the impermanence reading that represents Paramartha's original teaching about jiexing, which is a primitive form of the notion of originally existent uncontaminated seeds or Buddha Gotra found in Xuanzang's works. Conversely, this also proves that the awakening of faith was not connected with Paramartha. The traditional image of Paramartha, which became well established since as early as Xuanzang's time, is a result of misinterpreting Paramartha through the lens of the awakening of faith. Finally, I show that before Paramartha, Vasubandhu was among the earliest Yogacara thinkers who already incorporated Tathagatagarbha thought into Yogacara. So this book challenges three popular assumptions surrounding Paramartha, which I mentioned in the introduction. A, Paramartha was somehow responsible for the origin of the awakening of faith. I suggest that the awakening of faith was connected only with the Serlun Desh awakening of faith lineage headed by Tanqian. B, Paramartha and Xuanzang transmitted very different versions of Yogacara. I show that a more developed form of the notion of jiexing can be found in Xuanzang's works. C, Yogacara and Tathagatagarbha were two distinct and incompatible traditions in Indian Buddhism, I show that Vasubandhu already incorporated Tathagatagarbha into Yogacara. At least for Vasubandhu and Paramartha, Yogacara and Tathagatagarbha were not incompatible. And throughout this book, I emphasize a few times that the distinction between unconditioned versus conditioned is the key to understand the authentic teaching of Paramartha. Thusness, Dharma body are both unconditioned, and Jieqing, the enjoyment body, are conditioned. And there's no confusion whatsoever between these two in Paramartha's work. In contrast, it is a hallmark of the awakening of faith that thusness can permeate and can be permeated, a claim that abandons or at least compromises the distinction between unconditioned versus conditioned. Finally, I suggest that sinicization of Buddhism is a useful category because it helps to measure whether a Chinese text can provide useful information about Indian Buddhism. Suppose a text is highly sinicized, for example, such like the Awakening of Faith, then we must not use it to reconstruct our knowledge about Indian Buddhism. I also suggest that the easiest way to estimate whether a Chinese Buddhist text is sinicized is to carefully examine it first in a Chinese context, as what I try to show in this book.
Thank you, Qing, so much for this lucid outline. And again, I want to kind of put a plug for our aspiring scholars. As Professor Gang mentioned in the introduction, that he started this journey because of studied in Harvard together with his classmate Michael Radish, and then Professor Funayama's seminar on Paramartha. Yes. So all these references you can find in his monograph, but start with monograph and work back way to see how the field developed. Mm-hmm. And then maybe you can decide whether to study with any one of them. So, Qing, we've taken a lot of your time. Is there anything else in the book that we didn't have time to discuss here, but you'd like to highlight further for our listeners, readers, and maybe future students of yours?
I think I've give a brief summaries of the whole book, but let me repeat that the audience should feel free to contact me if I've already skipped a lot of details in the brief interview. So please do feel free to contact me.
Yes, I'll make sure I put your email there. So probably yes, You'll be flooded by emails. Last question.
Great honor.
Yeah, so our last question. Before we part our ways, I'd like to ask one last traditional New Books Network question. What are you working on? What keeps you busy?
Mm-hmm. Sure. I work now mainly on three fronts. First, related to this book about Paramartha, and a remaining issue is about the Lankavatara Sutra, because the Lankavatara Sutra is often cited to support the traditional image of Paramartha. As some of you may know, a famous phrase in the Lankavatara Sutra is, in Sanskrit, Tathagatagarbha Alevijnana Samshabdidaha. In English translation, it would be something like Tathagatagarbha is named Alevijnana, which seems to confuse the unconditioned, namely Tathagatagarbha, and the conditioned, namely the Alevijnana, and hence supports the Indian origin of the Awakening of Faith, and also the possible connection between the Awakening of Faith and Paramartha. To be honest, I failed to provide a satisfying answer to this issue in my book on Paramartha. So I've been working on the Lankavatara Sutra, and my tentative answer is the notion of Alevijnana in the Lankavatara Sutra is very different from the notion of Alevijnana in the Mahayana Sangraha by Asanga and Vasubandhu. And Alevijnana is unconditioned in the Alankavada Sutra, in my opinion. But this is a big issue, and I hope to share my research with you and the audience in the near future. And on a different front, I've been reflecting on the interpretation of Confucian philosophy by Mo Zhongshan, usually regarded as the most influential and most sophisticated thinker in contemporary Neo-Confucian philosophy. I criticized Mo's interpretation of Mencius because I thought Mo's interpretation of Mencius and Wang Yangming is too much influenced by the awakening phase. Namely, I think Mo Zhongshan actually provided a Buddhist account of Confucian philosophy. And finally, I've been interested in exploring how consciousness functions. In particular, how a sensory consciousness, for example, a visual consciousness, and a mental consciousness work together under the Abhidharma and Yogacara tradition. And together with Professor Mark Sideris and John Speckman, I co-edited a collection of essays entitled Buddhist Philosophy of Consciousness, Tradition and Dialogue, which was published in 2020 under Brio. So these are the main topics that I am working on right now.
Wow, that's a very wide-ranging kind of a different kinds of topics, but somehow linked to awakening your face in the background, loom there, mm-hmm. right? But thank you again for writing this important work and for sharing your insights and nuggets of knowledge that I really have to process further in the long term. And I'm looking forward to reading your new book soon.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Jessica, for your invitation. And again, it's my great pleasure to talk to you.